It's not clear how long Shechem had his eye on Dinah, but he laid out a plan to entice her, and at a certain point he succeeded in the sense that she left the tent, he kidnapped her, and he defiled her. When the word came back to Yaakov that Dinah had been kidnapped and had been defiled, the pasuk says he caused him great tsar. He didn't say anything. He waited until his sons came back from the field. And when they came back, they gathered to discuss what to do. Very shortly thereafter, Shechem and his father Hamor come to Yaakov to beg for Dinah's hand in marriage. And in fact, Shechem says, increase the price to whatever amount you want. Mohar, the ksuba amount, should be as much as you like. Name your price. I want to take this girl as my wife. B'mirma, with guiles, the Bnei Yaakov said to Shechem, if you want to marry amongst our people, you need to have a bris milah. Only circumcised people are welcome to marry Jewish people. If you wish to join us, the price to pay is you have to have a bris milah. Shechem and Hamor immediately agree. Then they go to their people, they go to the shar, to the gate, and they convince the people of their town to follow suit. They all circumcise themselves. On the third day, Shimon and Levi take their swords, march into that city, and kill every man in the city. And then amazingly, the pasuk says, when they were finished, and they were all finished, Bnei Yaakov bo al ha-chalalim, the sons of Yaakov, referring to Shimon and Levi, came onto the corpses, vayavozu ha-ir, and they spoiled the city. They took all the wealth of the city, ashetimu ha-chosam. The city that defiled their sister was the city that they spoiled themselves. They took back all of the wealth. And the Sfarim is bothered by a very clear problem with this pasuk, and that is the pasuk seems to indicate that the city was metame, defiled Dina. But the reality was it wasn't the city, it was one individual. Shechem kidnapped Dina. Shechem was ma'anes Dina. One man and one man alone. Yet the pasuk is saying, "Vayvozu ha'ir," the city that defiled, the city apparently was blamed, and the Sfarno is bothered by the problem, how could you blame a whole city for one man's action? And the Sfarno answers this question by saying as follows, "Kilule haya kvar davar zilti nimas," had this type of action not been no longer disgusting, they never would have done it. Meaning, the Sfarno explains to us, that after the time of Noah, the various nations were no longer promiscuous. They began setting up various gedorim parameters for Arias, and they were chaste in their ways. Apparently this town did not keep that custom, and therefore they allowed the standards to slide, and this type of idea where the head of the city forcibly takes a woman was no longer abhorrent, was no longer socially unacceptable. And the Sunnah explains that since this issue was no longer socially unacceptable, therefore Shechem was able to do it. Had it been abhorrent, had it been a disgusting act, Shechem never could have done it. But because these people were all participants in the standards becoming lax, therefore the entire city is held accountable. The whole city is considered guilty because they were all part of the lax standards. Those lax standards allowed Shechem to do it, therefore they're all to blame. And that's how the Sfarno seems to answer the question. But the problem is that he doesn't at all really answer the question. Because at the end of the day, let's say you're right, all of society were participants in there not being the proper standards. And now it was acceptable for the head of the government, the prince, to take any woman he wanted forcibly. Fine. All you can tell me is that the people in that city are guilty of allowing Shechem to do that which he wanted to do. They didn't aid him, they didn't abet him, they didn't tempt him. All they did, at best you could tell me, is they allowed him to do that which he wanted. But in no sense were they participants in the act. Yet the pasuk says the city defiled that woman, and the Sfarno seems to try to answer it by saying that they made the standards lax. But again, his answer doesn't seem to answer the question, because they did not participate, they were not active in this act. How could you say that they are to blame, that it's the city as a whole that is guilty? And I'd like to see this evening if we could answer this and get a better understanding of the Torah's perception of accountability and what ultimately a person is responsible for. And to do this, I'd like to make one very significant observation. Hungarian Jewry was by and large saved from the Holocaust until 1944. And because Hungary was together on the Nazi side, they were allies with the Axis Party, the Hungarian government effectively saved the Jews and would not export and deport the Jews, and therefore until 1944, the Jews in Hungary by and large were saved. However, very quickly it became apparent in 1944 that Germany was to lose the war. It was quickly apparent that Hungary was going to join the Allies, and at that point there was an overthrow of government, Hitler took over, and the deportation of Jews was almost immediate. And interestingly enough, it did not take a very long time at all. On May 14th, 1944, began the liquidation. In 56 days, almost 500,000 Hungarian Jews were shipped out to Auschwitz for the final solution. 56 days had spelled the end of an entire generation of people. And I want you to imagine for a moment the following. Imagine that you are a German train switch operator. Your job is just to make sure that the trains switch to the tracks appropriately, to make sure that things roll along as should be. Now, it'd be very hard to believe your claim that you were unaware of where this human cargo was headed, because the stench of burning flesh hung heavy in the air. However, your claim probably would be something along the lines, I was not a participant in murder. Granted, I was aware. Granted, I knew that you can't put 500,000 people into that area. And I was aware of the fact that over the past number of years, many, many, many people went in, no one came out. But at the end of the day, I was not a murderer. At the end of the day, I didn't kill a single Jew, and I may not have even really bought into the whole German racial theory, but I was following orders, just doing my duty. So here's the question, are you a murderer or not? Well, what's very interesting to note is that every Nazi, almost to a man, at Nuremberg used the following defense. I was simply following orders. I was not a murderer, I was not an arch criminal, all I was doing was following orders from above, doing as commanded. Amazingly, Eichmann himself was not a murderer. I do not know if Eichmann physically killed a single Jew. As a matter of fact, there are reports that when he actually showed up into Auschwitz and he saw what was going on, he began vomiting. He was not a tough man. Oh, he very much wanted the death of the Jews, and he was extraordinarily active in it, but I'm not convinced that he killed a single Jew with his hand. Yet no one in their right mind would excuse Eichmann's claim that I was just but following orders, because you, my friend, were the one giving those orders. And even if he was at the top of the chain, anyone below him who became a participant, albeit unwilling or willing, was a participant in this killing machine. And if you are a part of a killing machine, albeit a cog in the wheel, you're a cog in the wheel of a killing machine, you're part of that machine, and you are guilty by association. If it takes an entire nation to kill out 6 million Jews, and you're a part of that nation, you're a part of the killing process, you're a part of what went on, and you are guilty by being a part. Even if you did not pull the trigger on a gun, even if you did not gas a single Jew, if you are but the train switch operator who arranged that those trains end up where they should be, you're a part and parcel of the final solution, and you are guilty as charged. And I believe what the Sunnah is telling us is a step beyond that. You see, it's not just even if you're a participant in the machine of murder, but even if you're a step below that. You see, what the Sunnah is teaching us is that Shechem could not have done it alone. There was a normal society that would never allow this type of activity to happen. In a normal society, the head of government does not forcibly take a woman. It just doesn't happen. Society is obligated to make sure that things occur in the normal way that things are supposed to occur. And if there's such a tremendous breakdown in society where things that are abhorrent become permitted, things that are immoral become acceptable, then every member of that society is responsible because they were part and parcel of allowing it to happen. And what the Sunnah, I believe, is teaching us is a tremendous yesod. every one of those townspeople who were part of the now lax society are part and parcel of Shechem's act. Why? Because if not for them, it couldn't have happened. In a regular society, in a normal society, it wouldn't have been. Therefore, the guilt lies upon them. Now, I don't know if that was justification enough for Reuven and Levi to kill the rest of the town. If you look in the Rishonim, they explain they probably were chayav misa for other reasons. Namely, they were over the Avodah Zarah, etc. But the Pasuk is telling us that the entire city, as a unit, is considered the ones who defiled Dina. Why? Because since you were a participant, what do you mean I was a participant? I didn't do the act. I didn't ask him to do the act. Because you were part of the bringing down of the standards, those standards now being low allowed Shechem to do it, and therefore you're part of what happened, and you're held accountable for that. And I think it's a tremendous concept in terms of responsibility, in terms of guilt, in terms of understanding what a human being is held responsible for. And I think this concept really cuts very, very deeply to certain understandings in our current world, and I'll share with you what I mean. If you go onto any Arab website, if you watch any Palestinian news channel, and there are plenty of them, or if you watch even any of the children educational channels, you'll find a very interesting theory. The theory is that Israel does not exist. I don't mean that there are two states and Palestine is equal to Israel. I mean Israel does not exist. As a matter of fact, if you read the Palestinian textbooks, you'll find another phenomenal chiddush, and that is that the state of Israel isn't in there. In the geography section, you'll see Egypt, you'll see Syria, and then you'll see Palestine, which occupies the entire region that we know as Israel. And it's rather interesting that they teach some interesting examples. Here's from a PA, Palestinian Authority, school book. Coastal states differ in terms of their access to water sources. Some states have located seas on both coasts. For example, Palestine and Egypt have the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. Now, Palestine, if you know Gaza, and if you understand the what it's exposed to, it does not border the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. Nor is the Sea of the Galilee in Palestine. However, that is what's read in the textbooks in the Palestinian Authority areas. Here's another interesting thing. There's a talk show, you know, the little kids, they have shows where they ask quiz questions. So the host asked the following question. Please list three Palestinian ports. So the correct answer, which a child called in, was as follows. The three Palestinian ports are Haifa, Ashdod, and Gaza. Now, Gaza, I get. But Ashdod and Haifa, to my knowledge, the Palestinians never had a claim on that. The host answers, your answer is correct. I'll add a few more. We also have Haifa, Yafo, Ashkelon, Eilat, Ashdod. What you're witnessing is a major eradication, just eliminating the state of Israel. Now, you may say to me, okay, listen, there's a thing called chauvinism. There's a thing called nationalism. Maybe they're a bit too openly nationalistic. How about a little game that they have on a quiz show game for children on Palestinian TV? They have a hero. Guess the hero. So here are the clues, and then the children in the audience or who call in get to guess the hero. Here are some of the clues. His golden year was 1940 when his armies invaded Denmark, Norway, Luxembourg, Holland, and Belgium. By mid-1942, his country controlled the largest land area in Europe. He refused to surrender and continued to fight for two more years, but his bitter end came in the spring of 1945. Who is he? A young Palestinian fellow calls in and answers. The answer is Adolf Hitler. Yes, you're the winner. Yes, you guessed it. The hero for the day is Adolf Hitler. Okay, so again, you'll say to me that this is, all right, in Western democratic society, we don't educate our children that way. It's not what passes for primetime TV, nor even Sesame Street in our culture. But listen, it's just a part of a nationalistic thought process. Okay. Excuse my attempt, my poor attempt at humor, but two Palestinian bubbies, two Palestinian grandmas are exchanging pictures. And one gives pictures of her grandchildren, the other grandchildren. One looks at the pictures and say, "Oy, they blow up so quickly today, don't they?" Now, the reason why you're not laughing is because that is a very real part of the society of the Palestinian people. To the following extent, there are countless interviews with mothers, countless interviews with people who either committed suicide themselves, or the mothers, or the fathers, or the brothers, or the sisters of suicide bombers, which is an interesting expression. And let me share with you some of the expressions. Here's an interviewer who interviewed a Palestinian woman. And the question was as follows. Palestinian mothers are being called cruel, as if to say they encourage their children to kill themselves. Now that's a good question, how a mother could be cruel enough to encourage a child to murder himself. But this was the woman's answer, and I listened and saw her saying these words. Mother, we do not encourage our sons to die. We encourage them to shahada, for the homeland. Shahada means self-mutilation that gets you into paradise, because if you take a few Jews with you, you go right in there. We encourage them to shahada for the homeland, for Allah. We don't say to mothers of the shaheeds, we have come to comfort you. No, no, no. We have come to bless you on the wedding of your son, on the shahada of your son. Congratulations to you on the shahada. And in fact, when they come to the Shiva house, for us, morning is joyous. We give out drinks, we give out sweets. Praise to God, the morning is a joyous occasion. Now, maybe you'll say to me that that's one rather deranged individual, one mother who's lost her sanity. But we're talking about countless numbers of such interviews, one after another, where the person being interviewed just says, I've waited my whole life to marry the maidens. The maidens are the promise that if you kill yourself in the name of jihad, you will be ushered into paradise and you'll be given the dark-eyed eight maidens. That's your reward to come. One mother explaining her son's motivation to terror says as follows. He would always dream of shahada. It was his first and last goal in life. I told him, dear, we all want to be shahids. He said, in this entire world, I can't think of anyone to marry. I want to marry the dark-eyed. That's the reward when you get to paradise. I said, if these are your thoughts, I wish him shahada. Mother after mother describing the conversations with their children. Now again, you may say that this is an extremist voice. This is a rarity. But when you hear it over and over, and I'd like to share with you one more, because this one really is rather telling. An 11-year-old girl. Now 11-year-old girls are innocent, they're sweet, they're very, very, hopefully, gentle. An 11-year-old girl is interviewed, and this is the question. The question that's asked to her is as follows. If you had a choice of complete autonomy for the Palestinian people, if there was the opportunity to have absolute control of Palestine, or for you to be a shahid, which would you prefer? Now you have to perceive what's being asked there. The only reason you're blowing yourselves up is to free Palestine, right? That's the only reason that you're murdering yourself. So what if we tell you, you could have it all. There won't be a single Jew in the area. What would you prefer? The entire area cleaned of Jews, total control for the Palestinians, or your self-mutilation? She said the answer, of course we all want shahada. It's the most beautiful thing in the world. Who wouldn't want paradise? Of course I would choose it first. Now, what's amazing is that these interviews and others like them were shown at a Senate hearing, not last week, in 2003, and at the Senate hearing were high-level senators, including Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. And the expressions of the senators and the questions that they asked really showed that they got it. They understood that we were dealing with something that was so perverse, so out of the cultural norm, that there was no description for it. And if you listen to the words of Senator Arlen Specter, he said, a few days ago I had the opportunity to see some videos of young Palestinians talking about suicide bombing as an entry to heaven, an entry to paradise. I found these videos to be absolutely shocking. Then they show some of the videos that he actually saw, and then you hear some of the questions that Senator Clinton asked to the people who were defending this. And what you hear over and over is the fact that this is what we believe in, this is our approach. And if you're not quite sure, plug in. Palestinian Media Watch, which was brought as an acceptable, credible witness in a Senate hearing, has countless numbers of these interviews. You can go on their website, Palestine Media Watch, and you'll hear woman after woman, son after son, young boy after young boy, young girl after young girl, describing the fact that all they wished for is to blow themselves up to kill some Jews with them. They wish for paradise. Who wouldn't? So here's the question. The question is, who's guilty? Now, who's guilty? I guess it's pretty obvious that if you're a part of that society, you're guilty as charged. And I don't mean if you've blown yourself up. But I mean to say, if a suicide bomber succeeds, kills himself, and the entire town comes out in mass cheering the great accomplishment, cheering the great day of celebration that one of ours has done what he's done, that entire town is a part and parcel of that act. That entire town has a part of the guilt. But I think that's pretty obvious. And it's pretty obvious that the script writers, the cameramen, the people who play the stuff over the air, the people who print the textbooks, the people who distribute the textbooks, the society as an entity as a whole are all participants. It is not single, isolated suicide bombers. It's a society that's bent on destruction, and it requires an entire society to bring it forth. If it takes a whole village to make a child, it requires an entire Palestinian people to bring forth what they're bringing forth. And I don't think it's anything of a novel idea, anything of a chiddush to say that the entire Palestinian people are part and parcel of this. And what I'd like to share with you is two very significant observations. One is, what if you don't buy into this? What if you're a Palestinian who's educated? What if you went to Western universities, you became a lawyer, and you moved back? You moved back to Gaza, and you don't buy into any of this garbage. And you know it's wrong, and you know it's corrupt. But listen, what am I going to do? If I open my mouth, they'll slit my throat. They'll kill me. If I say one word, I am dead. So obviously then, you can't be blamed for this. Obviously you're not a participant. Well, my friends, I'd like to share with you a very, very interesting concept. And that is, when pure evil is being perpetrated, then your silence is acquiescence. And what that means in plain language is, you become a part of that killing machine. If you don't stand up and protest, if you don't leave, then you are part of it. Because it's not 1,000 people, it's 6,000 people, it's an entire village, it's an entire people that does it. And if that's what's happening and you don't stand up, then perforce you're part of it, even if you don't want to be. And I have to be honest with you, it's a very, very difficult situation to be in. I don't wish for such nisyonos. I don't wish for such tests, because I don't know how many of us would stand it. When you see things that you really don't agree with, and you really feel they're wrong, and you don't want to be a part of it, but to actually stand up and resist would take tremendous courage, would take tremendous moral fortitude, is not something that the average person can do. Yet it's something that every human being must do. Every human being is expected to, and if they don't, they're part of the parcel. Just like the railroad train operator in Nazi Germany who may not have bought into the racial theory, but if you switch the trains, if you arrange for this train to be there on time, and that train is carrying Jews as its cargo, you're part of the killing machine. And here, what the Sunnah is teaching us is a step beyond that. If these people allowed Shechem to become the animal that he was, if they created the social scene that allowed him to do what he did, they were part of it. They're partly guilty. And every single member of the Palestinian people who does not stand up and say in a loud voice, this is corrupt, this is absolutely abhorrent, becomes by force a part of that unit. But again, I think that's kind of obvious. I think there's another step that's not quite as simple. And that is, why is it that the secular media, Western civilization, doesn't get it? Why is it that Western thought is so much in favor of the Palestinians that if you open any news media, whether it be CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, you open it, you quickly and clearly get the understanding that Israel is the aggressor. The Palestinian people, Nebuch, are oppressed. All that you're witnessing is the anger, the humiliation of the Arab people, and we have to help them in their plight. And every time one of these Palestinian people blow themselves up to kill other people, you hear more and more of the bleeding heart liberalism. Nebuch, the poor Palestinian, look what's led him to that. Oy vey. And I'd like to share with you why I believe this is such a pervasive concept in Western media. You see, here's the problem. When you hear somebody get up and say, "In the name of God, I wish to kill myself," and you're a Western person, and you don't believe in God, certainly not in that way, what do you do with those words? What do you mean paradise? You believe in paradise to the extent that you're willing to give up your life? You believe in God to the extent that you're willing to mutilate yourself? It can't be. And I can't accept it. Why? Because I don't believe in God, certainly not in that way. I believe in God, you know, some misty kind of thing. Yeah, God somewhere. But a real palpable belief that you're willing to sacrifice for, that you're willing to give up your life for, that you believe in to the extent that you're really going to do this, cannot be. And therefore, invariably, the Western media, Western thought, paints a very different picture. There has to be something else going on here. Obviously, these people have suffered. Obviously, the humiliation, the being without a homeland. Obviously, what they're going through is so oppressive that this is the anger that's coming out. What you see is how severe the Israeli oppression has been. If this is what we see, it's obvious that the boot of Israel is upon them to such an extent that this is what it brings about. And again, the only reason that any thinking person could actually buy into that is because the alternative is too frightening. And that alternative is to understand that people really believe in God, really have beliefs, have religious beliefs, and are willing to sacrifice themselves on a regular basis for those religious beliefs. Now, with that comes a very interesting reality. That reality is that every time Israel does a minutia, a very small amount, to try to prevent the wholesale murder of its men, women, and children, the media comes out with a screeching cry, "How could you do that?" And world court holds Israel as the criminal, as the demon, as the worst of the worst. As you know, the extent of the UN criticism of Israel is beyond description. It is the most condemned nation ever in the history of the United Nations, far more than any other nation ever was. However, here really is the point. What happens is a very interesting thing. What happens is that Israel is held in check. And they're held in check to such an extent that they cannot effectively defend their own citizens. The reality is that unfortunately, 75% of our people living in a holy land are not religious, therefore they share a secular mindset. When they're criticized in the secular courtroom of the media, they feel it with such a powerful condemning force that they themselves don't have the moral fortitude to resist it. And the reality is Israel cannot resist, cannot do what they should do, what every sovereign nation would do, which is retaliate and put an end to it. No other nation would put up with this for a split second. No other nation would allow anything like this. A sovereign nation has the right to self-defense. But here's the most interesting part about the whole game. If you were to pick the following, Palestinians or Israelis, which is the one that's most like the typical European? Which one is like the typical French citizen, English citizen? So let's compare the two. In fact, let's do it with the following question. In the Middle East, which is the one country that allows Arabs full rights? Which is the one country that allows Arabs full rights to vote freely as they so choose? The answer is Israel. Which is the one country in the entire Middle East region where any Arab, has full rights not only to vote, but to become a member of the government? The answer is Israel. Which is the one country in the entire Middle East where any Arab has the right to university education, oftentimes paid for by the state of Israel? The answer, of course, is Israel. And if you look at any index, the standard of living, health, any index that you'd use, the Arabs have it better in Israel than in any other country in the Middle East. If you're not quite sure, just look at how they treat women in Saudi Arabia. Look at how they treat different caste systems in the various Arab lands, and you'll quickly come to recognize that Tel Aviv sure does look a lot like Paris, but Jeddah and any other Arab city sure doesn't. And you have to scratch your head and say, gee golly, this doesn't make a lot of sense. You would think that the Western media, certainly the European media, would be hugging and embracing the Israelis because they're so much like them. They speak the same culture, the same value systems, and the Arabs are so starkly different. Everything that the Arabs stand for is anti-Western, and everything the Arabs talk about is destroying democracy, destroying civilizations, destroying everything that the European Union holds valuable. And you got to scratch your head and say, gee golly, somebody's not getting something here. And what you're witnessing is one of the greatest farces in humanity. I don't think you could write a Purim spiel and anyone would even laugh at it because it's so comical that it's absurd to hold these Palestinians up high on a pedestal and say these are the aggrieved poor victims is so absurd that it's very, very difficult to imagine. I'll review just a piece of ancient history with you. When the Palestinians got a hold of two Israeli soldiers, they broke into the prison and they got a hold of two Israeli soldiers. I just want to revisit the scene. They ripped these two Israelis limb from limb with their bare hands. You saw pictures of them holding the organs, the human organs. They were holding it, blood drenching, with smiles on their faces, holding them out the windows while the rest of the crowd were cheering because they literally ripped human beings alive, literally, piece by piece. And this was witnessed, this was videotaped, this was shown, well, not clearly on CNN and not on ABC and not on NBC because it didn't really fit their agenda, but everyone was aware of it and the pictures were circulated wide and far. So why is it that at a certain point the Western man didn't say, something is strange here? They act, speak, and carry on like they're wild animals. They are not of human sort. They're not the typical person. And amazingly, the great darling of the Western media is the Palestinian, despite the fact that he speaks the words of terror, despite the fact that he speaks anti-democracy, and despite the fact that the first opportunity that he has to murder that reporter who looks at him with such favor is beyond human description. And every once in a while, these facts become more clear. Just recently, in India, there was an atrocity that was perpetrated. And I have two very significant points to share with you on that. The first point is that everyone felt such a sense of horror, such a sense of disgust. Two Jews who were such holy Jews, in reality there were six Jews, and in truth there was 196 people who were innocent, absolutely nothing that they had done wrong, and they were murdered. But especially to see the two Chabad, the couple and their young child, and to understand that they were tortured, everyone's heart was torn, it was written about, it was discussed, there were sifas, and it was really a tremendous, tremendous, heart-rending thing to live through. And while that's 100% correct and right attitude, I want to share with you something very, very significant. Since the year 2000, there have not been two or six Jews who've been murdered. Since the second Intifada began, there have been 1,000 Jews who've been murdered in cold blood. That's besides the casualties, that's besides the life-changing injuries. 1,000 Jews have been murdered in as brutal or more brutal a manner than that. And unfortunately, it's lost its sensationalism. It's lost the wow factor, and we're just accustomed to, some rockets landed in Sderot, killed some people, whatever, bomb blew up. Okay, it's just, that's what's normal. And every once in a while, it takes something astounding to wake us up and say, wait a minute, that is not normal. It is not normal to have your citizens blown up because they were drinking a cup of coffee in a cafe. It is not normal to have men, women, and children slaughtered because they're getting on a bus. And every once in a while you have to come to a sense of quite how perverse it is, quite how wicked it is, and quite how guilty everyone who is a participant in that is. My friends, if you'd like to know who shares the guilt, it's no great secret that the Palestinian people share the guilt. The little bit of an eye-opening concept is that everyone who supports them and allows them to carry out their demonic dreams is part of it. And that means every media vehicle that allows this to happen is a part of the crime. Every one of these reporters who whitewash the story and change it around. And by the way, if you really want to see it in beautiful technicolor glory, listen to how the reports came back about Mumbai. Here's how they were reported on the various vehicles of media. In India, a woman for her wedding, she's lucky to be alive, after teenage gunmen ran amok. Now, teenage gunmen is a very innocent expression. Teenage gunmen implies that there were some kids who went crazy. The Wall Street Journal, Tom Gross, wrote as follows on the Mumbai media coverage: the first time in an Indian terrorist atrocity, Jews have been attacked, tortured, and killed. The Indians are killing Jews now. Wow. Indians killing Jews. It's interesting. New York Times, an interesting line: it is not known if the Jewish center was strategically chosen or if it was an accidental hostage scene. Now let's do the math. There are 20 million occupants of the city. One Chabad house, unmarked, not a single marking on it. Happens to be a jihadist, happens to take it over. We're not sure if it was strategically chosen, even though the last remaining terrorist was interviewed, explained that for 1 year they were casing the joint. For one entire year they slept there previously, they had pictures, they had it all mapped out. We're not quite sure if it was strategically chosen because they were Jewish or not. That's rather interesting. But if you read the media's attempt to whitewash the situation, the word militant, specifically Islamic militant, is eradicated. It's no longer considered politically correct. We don't like to place blame. We don't like to point fingers. To call them militants, especially with the word Islam together with it, is very unsettling to many Muslims, and therefore we don't do it. And what you're witnessing is one of the greatest farces in humanity, one of the greatest crimes against humanity. And there are many times that a crime of omission is as significant as a crime of commission. Any person who doesn't stand up and say the truth is part and parcel of it. And I think what the Sono is teaching us is a tremendous yesod. Shem did not act alone. Granted, he was the one who defiled Dinah, but if he didn't have the rest of his town with him, he never could have done it. Therefore, they were considered participants, they were accomplices, they were together with him in that act. They may not have done the act, but they allowed it. If you allowed it, you're a partner in a crime. And that's exactly what the Nazis tried to hide behind. We were following orders. We're just a cog in the wheel. But if you're a cog in the wheel of a killing machine, you're a part of it, you're a killer yourself, and you're held guilty for it. Even if you didn't give the orders, even if you didn't kill a Jew yourself, you're part of it. Certainly, if you're part of a Palestinian people who propagate such hatred, such love for death, as long as we can take a Jew with us, you are guilty as charged. But the eye-opening concept is that everyone else who comes along as an accomplice, who allows it to be, is also part of the picture and is also guilty. And with that means much of Western society, a huge segment of Western society, the majority of it. And I guess as Jews, it shouldn't be that strange to us that it is us against the world, but the reality is that once again, the entire world has turned, and once again, they're focused on this evil Jew. They wear a different shade today. They wear a different costume. They speak with a much nicer dialect and a much more refined manner, but it's the same game with just a different color. And my friends, this concept also has one more application. And that application actually is a lot closer to home. And that is for us. See, what the Sona is telling us is, if evil is being perpetrated and you don't stand up against it, you are considered part and parcel of it. So what does that say to us? What does it say to us when within our own confines, there are things that are going on that any thinking person would call amoral, completely out of the range of behavior that is acceptable in any society? And the question is, why don't the Jews stand up and protest? And if you read about the various things that are accepted in American culture as normal, and the various marriages that are now condoned by different states, you have to ask yourself the question, why aren't the Jews out there rioting in the streets saying this is absolutely unacceptable, this is barbarism, this is the worst form of barbaric, when they kill babies in abortion clinics, when they involved in all types of mercy killings of people at different stages of life, why aren't Jews out there protesting? And I'd like to share with you the only answer to that question. The only answer to that question is that we are visitors in this land. We are in exile. We don't own this land. We are here on a short stay. We're not really members of the society. We're just here shortly to be returned to our homeland. However, that excuse cuts very, very thin when you start pretending that you own the streets of Brooklyn. When an issue that comes close to your heart comes up, and you take to the streets and protest, or you start rallying, or you start writing letters to the editor, or you start voting people in office or out of office, all of a sudden it waxes very thin, because apparently you're not the Jew in exile, you're not a visitor in a foreign land, you feel very comfortable here, so why then don't you speak out on issues of morality? And my friends, it's a concept that requires very careful analysis, very careful thinking. The correct attitude is we can't speak, because that's not a Jew's place in Golis. A Jew in exile is supposed to be very quiet, keeping a low profile, because at the end of the day, this is not our country. But that means that has to carry out through everything we do. This concept cuts very far and very deep. Obviously, it applies to Palestinians, it applies to the people of Shechem, it applies to the Nazis, but again, it applies to us in a very different way. I'd like to close with a story that I think touches very well on this concept. I've been zocheh to sit with Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld a few times now, and I've heard certain stories of his youth. And just recently he told me the following. When he was 15 years old, he was living in Vienna, and at that point the Nazis had already come to power, and they actually were entering into Vienna. And it was very clear that he could not last very long there. So he, with his family, boarded a train to get out. Now where they ended up was they had to go through Germany on the way out. He had never been to Germany before, and he stopped at a certain train station where they all had to get off the train, and they all had to show their documents, and the SS were the ones who were inspecting. So he showed his documents, and right away they saw the one suitcase that he was allowed to take, and the Nazi guard said to him, "What's in the suitcase?" "Just some personal belongings." "Open it up." Opened up the suitcase. Right away, the Nazi guard pulls out a siddur. "What is this?" "It's a prayer book." "No, it's not. You're lying. You're a spy." "No, it's a prayer book." "No, you're not." The Nazi guard takes it and throws it in the trash. He reaches in further into the suitcase, pulls out a tefillin bag. "What is this?" "It's, I put it on for prayer." "No, you don't. You're a spy. I'm going to hang you with them." The Nazi guard takes them and throws them in the trash. Finally, he sees nothing else in there, closes back up the suitcase, and says, "Get out of here." Now, Rabbi Schoenfeld was again a 15-year-old boy at the time. He started crying. His tefillin were in the trash, his siddur in the trash. He begins crying. The Nazi takes a stick and smashes him on the knees. "You wimp, get out of here." He quickly left, went back onto the train. He didn't think much of it. He's sitting on the train while the rest of the passengers come back on. And after a while, the train begins leaving. And a certain SS man, a Nazi, comes onto the train, looking at the passengers, and he spots young Rabbi Schoenfeld. He walks over to him and says, "Are these yours?" And he holds up the tefillin. Now at this point, Rabbi Schoenfeld described, he didn't know what was coming next. He said, "Yes, they're mine." The man said, "I want to return them to you." Rabbi Schoenfeld said, "What?" "I want to return them to you." "Why?" "Why? Well, I saw they were important to you." "I don't know what they were. I saw they were important to you. I saw you were crying. I didn't think I had any right to take them from you. I thought it was wrong. I want to return them to you." Rishon said, "But aren't you afraid that they're going to catch you?" "I wasn't afraid. I waited until he went for a cigarette break, reached into the garbage can, took him out. But what if he would catch you? If he'd catch me, I'd probably go to a concentration camp, maybe killed. So why'd you do it? Why'd you return this to me?" The man said these words, and I want to quote them exactly as I was told them. He said there comes a time in each person's life that he has to sacrifice for another person, and I couldn't stand by and watch you be harmed like this. That was a German who stood up at the risk of his life, even though he didn't know the value of this, but he understood that something was perpetrated that was wrong, something was evil, and he stood up and returned those children to a Jew. That is the moral fortitude and courage that a person has to have when he sees evil being perpetrated. It's a very rare trait. It's something that we're not often demanded to come forth with, but there are many situations in life when a person has to stand up, when a person has to stand forward, many situations in our own life, and certainly in Western civilization today, there are many such occurrences. May Hashem grant us that this is the very last stop in the exile. May we shortly be redeemed and not have to discuss these concepts further.